Hi, quiet day today. Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It's May Day, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, actually.
Yeah, come on.
Sorry. It's May.
May Day?
Close. It's Cinco de Mayo, May Day. It's Mexican May Day.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, we already celebrated in Judiciary this morning, actually.
Yes, we did.
Did you bring the hat?
I did not.
I thought you would wear it.
No, that was already designated.
So with that, we have just a few bills up today, and then everyone can go off and celebrate Cinco de Mayo. We will start off with a public hearing on House Bill 2132. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2132 modifies a number of provisions of the pilot program for transferring development rights. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued.
All right, and I think we have some folks from the Department of Land Conservation and Development like to come up. Jerry Lids and Catherine Davis.
Daniels.
Dennis?
Daniels.
Daniels, sorry. It looked like Davis.
Bad
handwriting.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Whoever wants to go first.
Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Lids. I am the acting director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. In 2009, as part of the Rural Jobs Act, the Legislative Assembly authorized a transfer of development rights program pilot, three pilot projects. The basic purpose of the program is to encourage a voluntary transfer of development rights, market-based, from productive forest land to more either urbanized areas or areas closer to developed communities. And basically the purpose is to protect forest land for productive forest uses. It's voluntary, it's market-based. It included a number of conditions and restrictions that were intended to do a good job of protecting sort of both ends of the transaction, the transferring area and not overwhelming the receiving area. However, despite working with property owners and local governments, we have not had any takers on these pilot projects. So House Bill 2132 is intended to respond to the concerns we've heard from local governments and property owners and remove some obstacles from their interest in the pilot programs. And we worked those out with a group of stakeholders, including local governments and forest land owners. Mm-hmm. So the bill includes some new incentives, enhanced transfer ratios, reduced requirements for high densities in the receiving communities, and so on. I would call these technical fixes. And on more detailed matters, I would defer to Catherine Daniels, who is here with me.
Okay. Catherine, did you want to add anything? Or?
If you like, I can explain the incentives. Otherwise, I can just answer any questions that you might like.
I would like to hear the incentives because I'm curious about what we can do to sweeten the pot, so to speak,
okay,
for a developer that is looking at TDRs as a tool.
Sure.
And
I'm
curious to hear about what the departments come up and the work groups come up with ideas about incentives.
Okay. The incentives are really intended to provide motivation.
Can you say your name again, please?
Catherine Daniels, Farm and Forest Land Specialist, DLCD. The incentives are intended to sweeten the pot both for the sending area landowner, the receiving area landowner, and the municipalities involved. So we tried to work at all ends on this. One of the things that we're doing is proposing to increase the types of qualifying receiving areas. Right now, under the existing pilot project provisions, the receiving areas can include urban growth boundaries, exceptions areas adjacent to urban growth boundaries, and two types of rural communities, urban unincorporated communities and rural communities. What we're proposing now is to allow two additional types of unincorporated communities to also be potential receiving areas. That would be rural service communities and resort communities if they have at least 100 dwellings right now. And another category of another type of receiving area would be exceptions areas adjacent to urban unincorporated areas and rural communities if they are brought within the boundaries of those communities. So those are two additional types of receiving areas. Other incentives we've placed in here are increased transfer ratios if the development rights are transferred into one of the types of rural communities. The transfer ratio could be 2 to 1. In other words, if you transfer one development right off of your property, it could become 2 development rights if placed within a rural community. Right now, the transfer ratio is up to local communities if transferred into an urban growth boundary, so it could be 3 to 1 or 4 to 1. It would cap that at 2 to 1 for transfer into an unincorporated community. Another provision, a change that we're proposing at the request of the forest industry, was to remove the public access requirement to the forest land. That was a concern to them for a number of reasons, but key among them was the fire hazard. And public access to lands under conservation easement is not a normal part of eased lands anyway, certainly not in farmland protection programs. That's not something you normally see. We also removed the language that refers specifically to residential transfer, so this would open it up potentially to transfer rights into commercial and industrial areas for increased densities or intensities. And let's see, and we also lowered the minimum density requirement for receiving areas in exception areas and rural communities. It was 10 units, dwelling units per net dwelling units per acre, and we were told by cities and counties that that was far too high, higher than existing densities, so we lowered that to 5 dwelling units per net acre, or in the case of exception areas adjacent to UGBs, actually the 5 would be adjacent to UGBs, and otherwise at least 125% of the average density within rural communities or within UGBs.
Okay. So those will be done, it sounds like, those will be done through rule, or, I mean, some of the language in here reflects that, but others are going to be done, you're going to go through another rulemaking, or how will that be done? Or they'll be negotiated as part of the pilot project?
I don't believe we've discussed that. I don't think we need to do additional rulemaking because this process is largely negotiated. This actual selection of the pilot projects. So I don't think we've already done rulemaking once. You know, for submittal deadlines and procedural matters. So
I think most of the changes that Catherine described are on pages 2 and 3 of the bill.
I didn't see the ratios in there, so maybe I was not
It's on
looking
page right. 1, the ratios.
Okay,
oh.
That's where. Okay. Sorry. Yep. That's where I was looking at. Okay, so this is, what was the ratio before? Was it 1.5?
It was 1 to 1.
Okay. So you're going from 1 to 1 to 2 to 1. Okay. So you don't think you'll have to go through additional rulemaking. Obviously, this probably would have gone to Ways and Means if... Okay. All right. Any questions for the department?
No.
All right. Anybody else signed up? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Anybody else like to testify on this? I see that the realtors are here. Sean? Okay. We got a thumbs up from Sean for the record from the realtors. We spent a lot of time talking about this in our destination resort work group, so just curious about. All right, so with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2132. You want to do a work session?
You can.
Yeah, we're scheduled for possible work session, so we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2132.
Madam Chair,
motion.
I'll move House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I will just add that this bill did come through our committee last time. This was a bill that Senator Schrader had worked on setting up transfer development rights program and obviously needs some more tweaking, and so we'll be interested to see if this tweaking means that we'll have any interest. Otherwise, I guess we may be talking about this again next session, where we don't really know what to say about could be the economy as well, obviously. That was a question that I had. But for now, we'll try it again and see if we move forward with the successful TDR program here in Oregon. The clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator House?
Aye.
Senator Pogoski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
He's excused.
Chair
Dinkfelder? Aye. With that, the motion carries. And Senator Przanski?
Sure.
Since you're a resident land use expert?
Sure.
After years and years of Measure 49, I think this will be a good bill for you to carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2132. Okay, we will open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2191. Beth?
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2191A. A would prohibit the Department of Environmental Quality from disclosing certain financial cost, production, or sales and data records obtained by the agency from a stewardship organization or specific producer as part of the approval of a plan or annual report. This is related to the paint stewardship program. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued.
Okay, and we have Palmer Mason and Scott Berry that wanted to come up, so you guys can come up together. Again, colleagues, this is a bill that passed from the House. It did not come through the Senate last session because it went to the Ways and Means Subcommittee that I sit on, and so we discussed it in the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and the program's been up and running for a little while and looks like it needs some tweaking, so we're here to hear from the department, and I'm assuming, Scott, you're representing industry?
Correct.
Okay, so go ahead, Palmer. Thanks.
Okay. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Madam Chair, members of the committee, what this bill does is it defines what public records the department could release when we get a request, a public records request, and that's the, as Beth pointed out, that's information relating to financial information, sales, production, cost information that's given to us as a part of the approval of this paint program. And basically this paint program operates by there being a per container assessment on the sale of paint at the retail level. And that assessment, that money, and it varies by the size of the container, is used by a stewardship organization. Paint Care is the stewardship organization, and they use that money to manage the paint appropriately when people return it back, and that's either managed in terms of disposal, recycling, or energy recovery. Paint, as it turns out, is a product that you can recycle if it's latex paint. If it's oil-based paint, which is a smaller share of the market and continues to get smaller, that is actually useful for energy recovery. And there still are cases where we have to dispose of the paint. But the whole idea behind this particular piece of legislation was to move paint away from the landfills, give people an opportunity to do more recycling and do more energy recovery. And to the credit of the paint industry, they came forward in 2009 and worked with the department to do this program, which is the first of its kind in the country. And made Oregon the test case for this. And since that time, California has passed a law. I think Connecticut is the other state, and there are other states looking at what we're doing out here. The issue that you have before you in House Bill 2191, again, relates to the public records. And in developing the legislation in 2009, there was a Scribner's error in the development of that bill, and it meant that there was potentially information that Paint Care, as a stewardship organization, or an individual producer of paint, which they'd have to give to the department as a part of the approval process, proprietary information that might be exposed to the public record request. And so we've been working with the paint industry, Scott in particular, and Ted Hughes, to work on some language that appropriately balanced the public's right to know information, as well as balancing the proprietary and information that the paint industry might want to keep confidential. And the balance we were really trying to strike is, I think it's fair to say the public has a right to know that this money, which is more or less a mandated fee on the sale of every container of paint in the state of Oregon, and is used for the public purpose of encouraging more recycling and the appropriate management of paint, that money is more or less almost like a regulatory fee that the Department of Environmental Quality might impose on another product. But it happens to be managed by a nonprofit organization, so there needs to be a level of public oversight and transparency about how the money's used. So on the other hand, for the paint industry, sales information, financial information is obviously can be very sensitive, and Sherwin Williams doesn't want another company, for instance, or Miller Paint doesn't want Sherwin Williams to know about their sales information. So our whole effort here with this bill was to try to strike that balance, let the public know how the money's being collected, what it's being spent on, as well as ensure, again, confidentiality, appropriate confidentiality for the paint industry. So that's what we were trying to do with this bill, and I think that we struck that balance the right way. The department can only disclose this type of information when we determine it's necessary for the public interest. And then when it's so determined that it's necessary for the public to know the information, there are limits in the bill in terms of how we can disclose it. It's only the information can only be disclosed in certain categories of information. And then at that, we can only disclose the information in aggregate form. And that's important because we were trying to protect the stewardship organization's relationships with individual contractors and subcontractors that they might hire to manage the paint and provide outreach and do the other things. So this is the legislation that came out of those efforts, and I can certainly take any questions the committee might have.
Okay. Let's see if there's any questions for the department before we hear from the industry. Okay. Go ahead, Scott.
Good afternoon. Scott Berry representing Paint Care this afternoon, and really I think Mr. Mason really covered the history of why we're here. It's a pilot program, and it's been extremely successful. As was mentioned earlier, a number of states have already copied it, and I think more are moving to do so. So we've been, I think, thrilled with the way the legislation was enacted last session, or in 2009, I should say, and the job that DEQ's done in working with us in making sure the program is working properly. Paint Care is a nonprofit, so if costs are reduced down the road, that cost will lead to fewer or lower cost per gallon for the consumer to recycle it as well. So I think that's important to know. Also, I would mention that DEQ, of course, does see all the information. And so in terms of making sure that somebody is overseeing, you know, what amounts are coming in and where they're going, those are available and those are seen at DEQ. So just to hopefully provide some additional comfort, the fact that that the numbers of the amount of money coming in and the amount of money going out and where it's going precisely is available for DEQ to review to make sure that the program is running properly. With that, I would just add that that this bill simply is to kind of clarify some of those disclosure issues so that, as Mr. Mason mentioned, certain competitors wouldn't be able to see their competitors' information, wouldn't be able to let's say, go through a public records request and now determine what another producer, their competitor, is producing in the state or how much they're selling in the state. That, along with the protection of those subcontractors, is kind of the key to this language.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
More of a statement. I guess it is a question as well. Scott, I'm familiar with in Lane County that they've been doing recycling of paints. Ring Recycling has a program where they're actually selling paint that has been reestablished. Do you know if it's part of this program? Do you know if they have a market in
Lane County, the Paint Care.
Chair Dingfelter and Senator Prezansky, I know that they're working. They have worked with both counties and cities, as well as a number of private pickup sites. I think there's over 60, 70 sites around the state. And I know that all the paint that comes in is either recycled or resold. And I'm not sure if Palmer knows about that specific location.
Well,
now
this one's
in Lane County.
I know it's blended.
Spring.
Yeah. They have it. I mean, they've had contract working on recycling stuff coming into one of the main transfer station, and then they have a facility that's off-site that's their own facility. And I know the last time I was in there, they actually had a display and the paints, a half dozen different colors that are available and stuff like that. And so it sounds like it may be somehow connected.
It very well could be.
Yeah, maybe you can follow up, Palmer. I mean, I know Metro's done a lot of work, and Metro has a lot of paint available, and they've had that, obviously, before this program started. But if you can check, and it would be helpful just to see statewide where all the programs are, I think it would
and,
be.
And, Senator, what was the name of it again?
It's Bring.
Bring.
It's Bring Recycling.
Recycling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Worked with them
over
the
years.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, but I can follow up.
Okay. And I think it would be helpful just to see how many sites and whoever is going to be carrying this bill. You want to speak to that? I think certainly just talk about the program and how it's doing. I think that would be helpful as well.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2191? No? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2191.
Madam Chair.
I will open up a work session first.
And I was waiting.
I should say that I'm opening up a work session on House Bill 2191A.
And I'll move House Bill 2191A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Prezansky moves House Bill 2191A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator
Haas?
Aye.
Senator
Prezansky?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator
Dingfelter? Aye. And Senator Olson is excused. With that, the motion carries, and do we have any volunteers? Senator Prezansky, that's two for two. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2191A. He just figures that he won't have to carry the other
one. And paint the town with this one.
Yeah. Oh. And I'm sure we'll get the answer about Bring Recycling before you're carrying the bill. That will probably be helpful. Okay, next we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2439. Beth?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2439 would increase damages for the taking of certain game mammals from $800 to $1,000. There is no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no statement was issued.
Okay, and we have former Representative Judy Stiegler with us here today. It's great to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being
here. Good to be here. Gotcha. For the record, my name is Judy Stiegler, and this bill comes to you as sort of a continuation from last session. You might remember that we raised the threshold amount of a Class C felony theft from $750 to $1,000. And this was sort of one of those things that got left behind in the process. This bill does a couple of things. First of all, it raises the threshold amount of game mammals that aren't specifically specified within ORS 496.705. And secondly, it clarifies that the damages ascribed to a game mammal in that section for the state fish and wildlife purposes is also the amount that is attributable for restitution purposes under the criminal statutes. In Oregon, hunting and fishing and wildlife viewing is greater than a $1 billion industry per year. And I am told by my sources, my reliable sources, that there are more deer that are poached than deer that are shot pursuant to a valid hunting license. So we have poachers who are outdistancing bona fide hunters by a long shot. The state of Oregon long ago determined that our wildlife in this state and our game birds, our game mammals, were a natural resource on a variety of levels. And I guess what I would say to you is that
by not putting some teeth to the statute, we allow poachers to rob this state of some of our natural resources. And additionally, what we do is we also sort of, I guess, enable the reduction in a very gainful industry in this state. So it's a nice, simple, straightforward bill. It raises the value for these non-prescribed game mammals up to the minimal value under the criminal statutes, and it makes it very clear that the value under the civil statute for restitution is the same under the criminal statutes. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Judy. And I don't know if there's any questions. This is an existing statute, and we're just increasing the fine from $800 to $1,000. Do you want to talk about that difference?
Well, under 496.705, I believe it is, mm-hmm. a, mm-hmm. It enumerates sort of the group of game mammals that don't have a specific, they're not considered trophy or, you know, anything like that, so they don't have a specific value ascribed to them. And prior to this time, they had been $800. In the process of both civil but particularly criminal prosecution for poaching, what we've done is de-escalated what this group of mammals then it potentially can be. You can't pursue them. They'd be a misdemeanor, and it would be not a felony. And obviously felony, you've got the greater restitution value that you can get, but you also have potentially other penalties that can be ascribed. So what this statute does is just sort of keep pace with where the prosecution of these kinds of things have always been. I talked to Representative Krieger about this, and you might know that he's a retired state police game officer, and you know, he's indicated that, you know, the only way you get any kind of handle on this is if you can have some teeth behind the statute. And so all I'm trying to do with this is to bring up the threshold level so that option's out there and available to prosecutors in prosecuting these cases. And the only other change, obviously, is in the criminal statute under Section 2 ORS 164.115. Under subsection 4, that's a new new section, subsection, and it just clarifies that the value ascribed under the game statute is also the value for purposes of criminal prosecution, so that's no longer an issue, and yeah, that makes it very clear.
Okay. Thank you, Judy. Any so no questions? We'll also, I think I'm going to have the department come up, and you're not going to get off the hook, Kurt, so you need to come up. Judy, why don't you stay up here?
Okay.
So, Kurt, thank you for coming up. If you could comment on any thoughts that the department has on this, and I'm assuming you worked with the proponents of this bill in drafting.
Chair Ding, fellow members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I think Ms. Stigler did a very good job of explaining this. So really, it just keeps this small change in terms of the value of some of these game mammals essentially allows the district attorney and a prosecutor to determine whether or not they want to charge an individual with felony theft, because it now meets the threshold. The threshold was raised from $750 last session to $1,000, which meant that these game mammals, some of them, were left behind, if you will. They fell underneath that threshold for being able to charge an individual with felony theft. This essentially just reconciles that, puts it back to where, for practical purposes, back to where we were 2 years ago, in terms of district attorneys having that latitude. And we do think that that's an important thing.
Okay. Any questions for the department? All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Judy, for coming and sharing your thoughts on this bill. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2439. We're not going to be opening up a work session at this time, but we'll certainly keep you posted.
Okay.
And with that, we will open up a public hearing on our last bill, which is House Bill 2748. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview. And we don't have anybody signed up, but I know that Rep. Boone is here. That's okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2748 would extend the applicability of exemptions for certain wave energy projects under the hydroelectric statutes. These statutes establish minimum standards. It applies to projects for which application is made to DSL on or before December 31st, 2021. There is a fiscal statement in your packet, and there was no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. Hello, Representative.
Chair Dangfelder and committee members, I hope I make it through this without coughing.
Uh-oh, I'm glad to stay on that side.
I know. I don't think I will infect you from this distance. But I'm coming before you today in supporting House Bill 2748, which is an extension of a bill, a sunset on a bill that you passed last session, Senate Bill 195, which was a one-year sunset on the ability for a wave device, energy device, to be put into the water and not be connected to the grid but be able to do the test so they would know if it's going to work or not. And currently there's only one device right now that's ready to go into the water for testing later this year, probably this summer. And if that's successful, it could be possible for other device developers to place a device in the water for testing without having to go through the entire array of permits. While we await work to be done to amend the territorial sea plan, include marine hydrokinetic energy development, which is kind of the new buzzword for wave energy, because there's more than waves being discussed, the device could be in the water collecting the data that's necessary. And there's been a lot of activity in this sector around the world. As a matter of fact, at 4:15 today, we're going to be having a call with an energy company in New Zealand, talking about one of their tidal projects that they're working on there. And the current power purchase agreements are maxed out. And so while we're looking for ways to increase our renewable portfolio standard resources, we are looking to the ocean more and more and tidal, and even inside bays and rivers, et cetera. Sources of renewable energy coupled with the need for the jobs that this sector will provide make it a win-win situation for Oregon. An early estimate calls for 13,000 jobs in manufacturing, operating, and maintenance of these structures. And our coastal community colleges are poised and ready to go, along with our university systems and their engineering programs, which they will collaborate. Currently in the Portland metro area, there have been created 35 jobs per buoy at Oregon Ironworks as they prepare the OPT, Ocean Power Technology Project, down the coast. Eventually, there will be additional jobs, and we researched these, and I may have missed some, but what I could find were jobs at NOAA, down in Newport, OSU, Hatfield Marine Science Center, NEMREC, which is the test site in off of Newport, Four Wave projects. American Bridge, Soss Brothers, and Merck, which is out of Clatsop Community College. These are for current and future workforce and coastal communities. We're doing many things in Oregon to prepare for this exciting new opportunity. We've done seafloor mapping. We're not quite done yet, but we will be hopefully soon. Marine spatial planning, fishing ground mapping. And these are all tools we can use to determine the best way to plan for our future energy needs that will allow all ocean users to coexist. I physically urge you to support House Bill 2748. And my compadres who are going to be here, one is on the East Coast in a meeting, and the other one's in Portland in a board meeting and couldn't come, and that's Justin Clures on the East Coast, Jason Bush, who's the director of Oregon Wave Energy Trust. And you've been given a letter, which is his testimony. I'm not sure if you want me to read it or not, but support it too. I can tell you that.
Yes, we have copies of all that, so yes. Appreciate that. Okay. And appreciate all the hard work that you've done on this, Representative Boone, over the years. And I did get a chance to tour Oregon Ironworks last summer and saw the buoy in the making, and it's huge.
It's huge.
So yeah. I'm
some of these devices aren't quite that big.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big one.
It was a huge facility I was in, and they were working on all the parts, so I'd be very interested to hear how it goes when they get in the water, and hopefully it'll be successful. But I did get a tour, and I talked to them about the number of people that were working on the production line, so to speak, just for that one buoy, and that's exactly what they told me, 35 jobs.
Oh,
so
job.
It's very interesting, and I know that they're looking forward to hopefully being able to construct more buoys if this is successful. So that's excellent. Any questions for the representative? Senator Przanski is not going to let you off easy.
Well, I just want to get some stuff on the records because I think some people are going to wonder, and I mean, my first guess at this, knowing that this just passed last 2009, now we're looking at extending it out to 2021. That's a pretty long period of time. And so can you put something on the record as to why the extension and how far it's actually being extended?
Right, and you will see it in my testimony, too. At the time, there was only one buoy that was, or one project that was going, and they only wanted it for that short time. There didn't seem to be anything else in the making. So we said, would 1 year be enough? They said yes. They just wanted to get it in the water and try it out. We expect, because already in just Tillamook County alone, there are three companies that are interested. These are all different technologies. And one of the biggest reasons for extending the test period availability is for them to decide, A, if they're going to come here and they like Oregon, they like the way things are. We are looking at increasing the testing capacity at NEMRIC, which is down off of where the new NOAA site is, and there might even be other areas in the water, and those are, it's just basically a piece of real estate where they will test a device, and it's been determined by the scientists, the fishermen, and all that, that this is a place they accept. And so if they decide to have one or two more or something like that. But these projects are multi-year projects. They're multi-year from planning to getting the investments for them. And I think that's a lot of the reason, and we asked them what kind of time frame. The people of the project in New Zealand are looking at 35 years for theirs. So okay. It's just to give them enough time to get all their ducks in a row.
One follow-up. Understanding this is really extending a time for they can get under the current regs for these testings. Is there tax credits tied to this at all?
Nope.
Okay.
This is just a way to get their device in the water. It's not connected to the grid. That's a little disappointing to me. I would like to have seen them be able to at least power the nearest town or whatever, but it's not connected, so that's why they can do it this way.
And I have a question, and I know that Louise Soliday is here from Department of State Lands, and we also have Brenda Bateman from the Water Resources Department. So I actually have a question for the agencies, so maybe you
they can come
two
up
can
here.
Come up. You may not want to sit too close to Representative
Boone.
Yeah,
I'll leave. Yeah. I'll go over here.
Yeah. Any other questions, though, for Representative Boone?
Day, so it's probably not bad.
Yeah, that's what they all say.
Yeah.
I never get sick either. I said that last time.
Right. Knocking on wood.
Well, I had a okay, so
I made a mistake.
Whoever would like to go first?
Go ahead, Brenda.
You're going like this.
Madam Chair, yes. Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. So I just reminded Representative Boone, this bill actually does allow them to connect to the grid to test. So that's the reason why they actually need this legislation, the exemption from the fish statutes, so that they can actually get those in and connect to the grid and test with it connected to the grid.
And we had a question about the time frame. Was this something that the agencies weighed in on? Because I did, as I was reading the bill, I thought the same thing. We just did this. And do you have any thoughts on the time extension that's being proposed in this bill?
Madam Chair, we didn't weigh in on the time frame. I think the original bill actually removed the sunset completely, and I think the committee put the sunset on, not wanting to leave it out there forever. And I think the idea is that this is a really brand new industry that really is just under development and starting to test devices. And I think, you know, the 10-year period of time gives all of these different companies who are testing different models to get in and actually test before they make a decision about a major investment in a commercial operation.
And one question I have is to, and I was looking at the statute, and Debbie can probably, or Representative Boone can actually probably respond to this as well. So are they at the same time applying to FERC for a license? So they're applying while they're doing all this testing, because I do know there's a lot involved, obviously, with the FERC licensing as well.
So, Madam Chair, they do have to apply for a FERC license. In order to identify an area in the territorial sea where they want to place devices, there was a rush on preliminary permits at FERC in 2007 and early 2008. Several of those have expired, and some of those companies, I think, have decided not to. There are some new companies now coming in. Applications are not going to FERC for projects in Oregon because we have an MOU in place with FERC and the state to give us time to get the territorial sea plan amendment done on these energy devices in the territorial sea, so that we can get the mapping done before FERC goes back and authorizes preliminary permits for areas of the territorial sea again.
And then I had a question for Brenda about the rulemaking that's down in subsection 3 of section 2. With the Water Resources Commission may adopt rules. So do you anticipate that? I'm just concerned about any financial impacts because the fiscal statement did not necessarily, was it indeterminate? Just sort of had a description, but I'm curious if I didn't see that there was any inclusion of rulemaking.
Madam Chair, we likely will not need the rulemaking as most of this language was carried over from Senate Bill 195 in the 2009 session. This was something that was very important to us originally. It still is, but wanted the option in there to participate in a rulemaking. And part of this was the adaptive management. As these are pilot test projects, they'll learn as they go. We wanted to make sure, and so did coastal communities, wanted to make sure that we have an ability to get in there and make adjustments as needed. So this was added as permission to conduct rulemaking in order to adjust pieces of the project as necessary. You mentioned the fiscal. You're right. That's not reflected in a fiscal. If it comes to a rulemaking, it will be a minimal fiscal, just done with resources that we have today.
Yeah, the fiscal is mainly about ODFMW's resources as far as looking at fishery impacts, and so I was just curious about that, and I'm assuming that is probably going to be in the future. Kurt, I might want to have you come up because we're reviewing your budget, and I didn't recall if there was a position in there specifically for hydropower projects, so I want to make sure we're not adding to your workload. Or Rep. Mann, if you want to...
I was going to add, Madam Chair, in terms of the fiscal specifically, with opening up a window of opportunity for folks to apply for these projects. If they do apply, there would be fees that would come with that. And so there's a fee structure already set up today where we receive those and distribute them to our sister agencies so that we can all work on those permit applications together. And that's with already existing program structures.
And thank you, Deborah Boone, House District 32, for the record. The project that we did last session that enabled the marine map to become reality, and they're doing a lot of the studies through that, the collecting data on that. So a lot of the fish data, socioeconomic data, all that stuff it's a very interesting and user-friendly product. And I know that they're working on it. I think they've completed that. OWET paid for that and ODFMW. So they got a lot of data out of that.
Okay. And maybe we'll have Kurt come up and just finish up with just talking about the fiscal, because it is the bulk of it is with ODFMW.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I think with regard to staff workload, it was really associated with these projects when and if they become in the application stage and in the development stage, frankly, not in this exploratory research phase. And I think, and you all know, that as these projects come online and we move beyond just this little exploratory phase, much like other energy development projects, we're going to be faced with the standard trade-offs and policy discussions on competing uses and balancing uses of the ocean and all those associated issues that go with that. But I think our staff issues are down the road as these projects become more formal and developed.
All right, thank you. Any other questions or questions of the agencies? All right.
Thanks.
You very much.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and close. Anybody else like to testify on House Bill 2748? Okay. With that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2748. We will open up a work session on House Bill 2748.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2748 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves House Bill 2748 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I just wanted to thank Representative Boone again for her work, and we'll look forward to seeing how the test goes this summer if the buoy goes in. Clerk, will call the roll, please.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Olson?
Excused.
Senator
Aye. That the motion carries, and I will carry the bill to the floor. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2748. Beth, any other business?
Nope, that's it.
And Tuesday, we have a fairly full agenda, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We'll look forward to seeing everybody here at 3 p.m. on Tuesday. Have a great weekend. With that, we are adjourned.
Yep.